how did you end up on Prince Edward Island? Why did you come here? What's the story there?
Well, I went to UNB, mm-hmm. so it wasn't that far. First time I came here, I really loved the place. And then I had a good friend, and also the woman who ended up being my wife here. And they kind of like everybody, I came for a summer, mm-hmm. and I was hooked. The beaches, the land, the smallness of a place. You know, it's of a size that you can get your arms around it.
Yeah.
It becomes yours.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Quebec, in Montreal.
Okay. And so you were at UNB studying, and you just kind of came here out of interest?
Actually, I came over for a football game. I was on the team and came over for a game, and just, you know, that was the first time I was here. I loved it, and kind of made a mental note that I got to go back. And land was so cheap, eh? And in the early 70s, land was ridiculously cheap.
Yeah.
So in New Brunswick, you could buy 100 acres, a 100-acre farm and a house for like $1,000 or $2,000.
Really?
But it was a long way from the ocean. And once you saw that ocean and the cheap land, you know, and the fear of sitting at a desk and mm-hmm. leading a faceless, useless life.
Did you have friends that went back to the land, or was...
No, it was such an interesting... It interested me greatly. I always wanted to work with my hands. You know, I mean, I had a forge set up here, determined to be a blacksmith, when my father told me that my great-grandfather was a blacksmith. You know, it's like, it's in your blood, I think, and I think working with your hands, mm-hmm. building and creating, homesteading, mm-hmm. I think that's in everybody. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a dream, a kind of a creating for yourself. That we had people with very little means had an opportunity mm-hmm. to own their own land and own their own house. Like, when did that ever happen in history? When the young and the poor... could live such a rich life.
Right.
So I think it was just the excitement. Plus, there was a lot of countercultural stuff happening then, eh? And the big city jobs were rejected. Even growing up in the suburbs of Montreal, the best things that happened to me were on the weekends and in the summers outside the city, out in the country.
Okay.
So,
were you a summer camp?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And when was it you came to Prince Edward Island?
I came, the very first time was when I first saw it was the fall of 67.
Okay.
And I came, but I came here to, you know, for the summer in the summer of 72 and moved here permanently in the fall of 73. I always wanted to build a house mm-hmm. and a couple of very close, longtime friends. We had the same, the three of us had this idea that we were going to build a log house. Mm-hmm. And we bought land. We bought 50 acres for $2,500. Mm-hmm. And we moved into a community that had a lot of old farming couples and no young people. They had all left. We passed them on the boat. As we were coming, they were going to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And... So we bought a chainsaw for $35 and built some tent platforms and moved in and I don't know where we got our money, but we didn't work except for picking potatoes and I fished lobster, but I made $700 for the season. But we found enough money to build a large log home over 2 years, a 36 by 24, two-story home. And the experience was in the building of it. Mm-hmm. Three guys became three couples. Three guys might live in a house together. Three couples ain't going to.
Right.
So two of us sold out to the third.
Okay. What community were you building in?
Hopefield. My closest neighbor was Pat Binns.
Did you end up staying in that area when you sold your share of the house?
Or? Not far. That's okay. Where I live in Mount Vernon today.
Okay.
So it's, you know, Hopefield, Iris, Mount Vernon.
These people that you were building with, were they classmates from UNB or were they from Montreal or?
Both.
Both, okay.
Both. I knew them before UNB and, you know, the trust was there at UNB and then we had this idea to do this. Once we had the experience of the log house, I got the idea to go into carpentry as a trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so did this other one who he's now in down in the States as a contractor.
Mm-hmm. So after you moved out of this place, did you go and build your own new place?
Yeah, continue with twice. Twice. We built one house and then moved on, and now we're in the house we built after that.
Okay. So, and they're both in Mount Vernon? Or?
They are.
Okay. And so, really, what did the Back to the Land lifestyle, what did it mean to you? How did you try to pursue this? Or do you even use that term for yourself?
Back to the Land, that's the term I use.
Okay.
That's the term I use. Others use the word hippie, but I never felt like I was. I was a back-to-the-lander.
How were you living the back-to-the-land lifestyle?
Well, we were clearing woods, for building a house, growing a garden, raising pigs and chickens, and it was anti-corporate culture, which, you know, there was a lot of spin-off from the anti-Vietnam War movement and the lack of trust with the establishment, and it just seemed the way to live in an honorable way, and we could see our way to owning land and a house and never having to have a mortgage, which again, you know, boxes people in. You know that Woody Guthrie song, Little Boxes on the Hillside. We had grown up in those, in the suburbs, with that. You know, that was, we were rejecting that. Men don't think of settling down anywhere where there isn't an attractive woman they've fallen in love with.
Right.
And she wanted to live this life too.
Okay.
And she has a Ukrainian background, and you know, two generations before that, her grandparents had chickens, and you know, growing up in the summers north of Montreal, they lived kind of a real European life.
How did you earn a living while living back to the land, especially early on when you came in the? I guess you first came in the late 60s, right? So,
well, trying to earn a living as a back to the lander, I started in, say, the fall of 73.
Okay, fall of 73.
I'm still trying to figure that out. We must have had little jobs here and there, and our wants were little. I didn't have a car. I did a lot of hitchhiking. And I would pick up an odd job here or there. Somehow we made it.
Yeah.
I borrowed some money from my father and then, you know, went out west to make some money to pay it back and then for a winter and then came back to the island in the summer.
Mm-hmm. So I guess odd jobs, a lot of that would be working
with lobstering. Picking potatoes, doing carpentry work.
Right.
It wasn't the focus. I mean, again, that the kind of the corporate focus was making money. So, you know, there was money wasn't the issue. There was lots of fun to be had that didn't require money.
Mm-hmm.
Campfire and a guitar.
All right.
So there wasn't a lot of need for money.
Okay. Well, you're keeping your overhead.
I still don't know how we did it.
What was the reaction of the locals to all these people coming from other areas and moving into the rural parts of the island?
I would found like almost 95%, 98% were incredibly supportive. old guys coming over with their tractors and hauling logs out of the woods. Mm-hmm. We'd go and pick their potatoes for $16 a day and be fed by them. And they were just so pleased to have young people coming into the country and being their neighbors, because a rural community depends on there being people at every level, at all the different generation levels. Mm-hmm. You know, you need babies, you need young kids to work and fill the schools, you need 20-somethings to start families and get the future going, and you need the old people for the culture. And so we filled a really welcome role, I found. Mm-hmm. Who'd have done their hay? It wasn't the labor.
Right. So all the other young people are moving away.
They're gone. Their sons and daughters have moved away. Yeah. And there we were, and, you know, six burly guys and doing the hay and women as well, and picking the potatoes. You know, the women worked right beside the men. And remember, these were women who were feminists at the time. They were very strongly women's movement oriented, and that was supported by the men. You know, there was an air of equality and shared labor, and so it was they were heady times.
Did you have any special bonds with any particular neighbors? Did anyone really take you under their wing, help you out?
In Flat River, my wife's folks bought a house for $8,000, a house and a barn and 3 acres for $8,000. When I just kind of came one day to visit her and never left. And our next door neighbor, Stuart Ross, he was at the time he was an MLA.
Mm-hmm.
And he had grade 4 education. He was one of the smartest men I'd ever met. And he taught me the difference between schooling and education. And we play cards, we play cribbage endlessly for the 3 years that I lived in Flat River. And we were very close. Hardly a day would go by when I would see him. And we talked about everything. I'd listen to his stories, and he was so helpful to us. And I just, I miss him to this day because of how rough his life was, how rugged, and how well he did. Mm. He was a very well-respected man. And in Hopefield, there was a gentleman by the name of Leon McPhee, who was just loved the young people, especially the women. One thing the old guys did was they didn't mind falling in love with the beautiful women that were there. So we took great care of him and his hay and Alden Blue, another one, digging his potatoes, and Ivan Blue, just everybody on the road that, you know, you made a connection with was really solid, and we've known them until they died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all gone now, but they were all so pleased, and these guys, I'd say my favorite was Stuart Ross and then Leon McPhee, and they were the two that, I'm sure there's others if I think about it.
What about the back to the land community itself? Because there's that, you know, I've talked to a number of people in that Hopefield, Lewis, general
yeah.
area. Was that something you really could?
That was big.
Yeah.
That was big because, you know, we had grown up very different lives. We were used to very different lives, and we were creating a new life and we could relate, and the local people could relate to us easily, kind of Monday to Friday. But on Saturday night, they had their entertainment, whatever it was, and it seemed like the Back to the Land community had its entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't forced to get together on a social level. It was a very slow integration. And there was an awful lot of music that there's a lot of folk songs and singing and kitchen parties that were great. And rather than maybe party with your farmer neighbor, you know, a bigger party would be, there's, you know, Back to the Landers up in Cardigan that you got to know. And
mm-hmm.
Didn't know the Back to the Landers west of town very well.
No.
We didn't know them, ran into them later.
Yeah.
Heard about them, could meet them in Charlottetown and hear about them as they got involved in arts organizations. But
Did you happen to play with the Back to the Land softball team?
I did. I was a member of the Irish Cow Pies.
Irish Cow Pies?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we played against the Lost Dogs. The Lost Dogs were mostly American.
Mm-hmm.
And they were challenged when they played hockey. We all played in the same hockey team, which was the Culloden Clippers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were terrible skaters. So when summertime came, they were anxious to show off their ball skills, and they were excellent ball players. Like, one of them, Robert Katz, was a backup to Thurman Munson at Kent State. And Thurman Munson, of course, went and played for the Yankees. So they were excellent ball players. Jim Hunter, another excellent ball player.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cow Pies, the Irish Cow Pies, were determined that we would be able to, you know, be the measure of the Lost Dogs, and it was a great rivalry over the years.
Right.
The Dogs had better individual players, mm-hmm. but not enough of them.
Right.
The Cow Pies were all sort of average, and but there was enough of us to make a team, so
mm-hmm.
the games would seesaw back and forth. Later on, the Lost Dogs kind of moved into up into higher leagues.
Okay.
And up there. They were players that weren't that accomplished, and they were, you know, those Americans from away that were good ball players, they got a lot of recognition for their abilities here.
Mm-hmm. And the Cow Pies, that was back to Landers as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell there was a healthy irreverence to the whole thing.
What's the best part of your lifestyle? What's the best part of being a Back to the Lander that you experience?
I would have to say it is the space, the freedom, the room we have without, you know, somebody like, everyone has acreage, right? And in the suburbs, there's five houses per acre.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fact that it's something you're able to create yourself, And that year after year, it's more and more redeeming. It just makes more and more sense every year. The fact that we never had to have a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
We were very poor. I mean, we had outhouses and hand pumps, and we were pumping our own water. We lived in a school bus for 18 months while we built our house. And we didn't call it suffering. We didn't even know we were poor. We were comfortable in our poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was that we were able to provide a way of living and a wonderful lifestyle that was so agreeable. And we had so much control. Okay, you want to bring it down to one word? We had control over what most people don't have control over.
What was it that made you want to stay?
Well, after you've done this for a while, you really can't go anywhere. Well, a lot of them left, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones that had strong relationships, I mean, the couples with strong women, they led successful lives. Because it takes a lot of work, eh?
Mm-hmm.
It's a tremendous amount of work. It's twice the work of living in the suburbs, I would think. And both couples, both members of the couple, and the kids as they came along, you had to be workers.
Right.
You had to like to work and find pleasure in it, and because it's endless. But it was fun, so it didn't seem like there was no drudgery about it.
What were you talking about, all this, the extra work, the labor you actually have to do living back to the land? What are the major challenges that you faced?
Well, there's always the financial one. Where's the money coming? Because we're building houses. Mm-hmm. And then there was the skills. That was the pleasure, is picking up the skills, the construction skills, the, you know, learning how to milk a cow and collecting the eggs every day. There's this huge sense of satisfaction when you see a big pile of firewood stacked. You know, and winter, it starts to snow and your wood's in, your freezer's full, and you're ready. Mm-hmm. And the ponds are frozen, and let's go for a skate. You know, you're in the right place at the right time.
Did your current business kind of develop out of your back-to-land skills?
Absolutely. I run a construction company.
Yeah. And when did that start?
In the early 80s.
Okay.
We kind of moved from carpentry to masonry.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, you know, grew a body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
More and more over the years.
Yeah.
I never had a job.
Mm-hmm.
I never worked for anybody else, so starting the company was a really straightforward thing.
Be your own boss. Oh, okay.
Yeah. It wasn't so much be your own boss as that sense of separation, but still that sense of, you know, a job was was capitulation. Getting a job was capitulation.
Really?
I didn't want a job. And I actually really never thought about it. The opportunities were there.
Mm-hmm.
I found opportunities to build this building, to build that building. And the downtime in between wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
I guess there was a kind of a freedom from any kind of regimentation.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. You know, there was no drudgery.
Was there any construction in your background, or?
Not really. No. My dad's an engineer.
Yeah, okay.
But I more gravitated to the arts side of things than the science.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to, it was a religion, eh?
Yeah.
Being a back-to-the-lander was a religion.
How so? How so? Is it just the worldview that makes it into a religion, or?
Yeah. Yeah, and the work ethic. You had to believe in this, that it's a good thing to do. So,
but how does somebody? I mean, you mentioned how you like working with your hands and the suburban lifestyle wasn't attractive. But how does the back to the land, this countercultural idea, is it communicated to somebody in university? Is it just through the music? Is it books? Is there anything in particular you'd attribute it to?
Well, it happens gradually, like going to school in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
You'd meet people. You'd met people in Fredericton. You'd met a lot of Americans that were dodging the draft. You'd just get across the border and look for land between Fredericton and St. Stephen. You met them. They bought farms. You saw what they were doing. It became a viable option.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen so many people doing it. And then you stumble on a big party and you go, gee, this is fun. And it just seemed, I mean, there never was any question that this is what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be in New Brunswick because I wanted to find it. Once I came to PEI, it became very clear that I had to be on PEI, and there was enough like-minded people that we could have a fantastic time.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just like you see a really nice painting and you just like to have it, or like to be in it, or don't like to be part of it. And I don't know, it's hard to say. It was just a line of least resistance. I have a friend of mine, or a guy I know, who came to PEI in 1981, and I hired him very briefly before he went on to better things for a tree planting contract. He told me the other day, because there's a lot of discussion about what kind of system works best, and collectivism or socialism, and he says that I said that I thought the best system was rugged individualism. Where you just, there's a collective, your community is a collection of rugged individuals, everybody working hard and thriving and cooperating. And so I had to chuckle. I said, did I really say that? And he said, you did. One thing that I've said maybe too many times, I'll say it again. There's a lot of Back to the Landers that didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And I alluded to the fact that about the women and the work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said, you show me a successful country couple, and I'll show you a hardworking woman. Because
mm-hmm.
the guy could be a flake, but if the woman was hardworking, they'd make it. But if the woman was flaky and didn't have a work ethic, no way were they going to make it. They were going to end up cold, in the winter. It just wasn't going to work for them. So,
is that just because of the, the division of roles within a couple, or is it because the women really carried the ball?
Well, just look all over Africa. Who is the stalwarts in the community? The women do the work, and the men sit around. It's no different here.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we were living a third world lifestyle, and the women could carry. If the women would carry the load. So, I mean, that's the one thing that I remember is, like, if you want to pick the high points, it's cheap land, how welcoming the